Welcome to the Digital Identity Digest, the audio companion to the blog at Spherical Cow Consulting. I'm Heather Flanagan, and every week I break down interesting topics in the field of digital identity, from credentials and standards to browser weirdness and policy twists. If you work with digital identity but don't have time to follow every specification or hype cycle, you're in the right place. Let's get into it. Welcome back. So last month's AWS outage did more than just interrupt chats and scramble payment systems, right? It ignited an argument that's been simmering for years, decades. Whether cloud platforms have become too essential to be left entirely in private hands. In the UK, calls for digital sovereignty resurfaced almost immediately. Across Europe, governments and enterprises once again questioned their dependence on US providers. And even for organizations that weren't directly affected, the outage felt uncomfortably close. I mean, the internet wobbled and everybody noticed. In my post last week, The Infrastructure We Forgot We Built, I argued that private infrastructure now performs public functions. And that's really the question here, not whether these systems are critical infrastructure, which is a very specific legal term. But if you do decide that they are, what happens when everything becomes critical? When every failure becomes a matter of national concern, the language of protection kind of starts collapsing under its own weight. So just a quick reminder, what do we mean when we say critical infrastructure? Because the phrase sounds fairly straightforward, but it isn't. Every jurisdiction defines it differently. But broadly speaking, critical infrastructure refers to the assets and systems and services that are essential for the functioning of society and the economy. Things whose disruption would cause major harm to public safety, economic stability, or national security. And that really works just fine when you're talking about the power grids and the water systems. It gets complicated when you start talking about things like DNS and payments or authentication services, the digital glue that's really holding so much together. And yet that's exactly where the conversation is going, right? In a world where Stripe outages can halt commerce, or Twilio downtime can silence emergency alerts. Critical isn't just about the physical survival anymore. It's about functional continuity and keeping society running. The challenge I see is that each country's list of what's critical keeps getting longer, broader, and kind of fuzzier. And declaring something critical once meant ensuring its safety, but now it just feels more like taking a claim to control. And that creates an interesting paradox, right? The more we classify, the more we appear to protect, but the less effective we actually become when the next outage hits. And I'll dive into that a little bit more. So that paradox is particularly visible, I think, in the United States. Critical infrastructure used to mean 16 sectors, including energy, water, transportation, and communications, things that you could easily point to in the real world. Today, the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, has expanded that list into over 50 so-called national critical functions. They define these as the functions of government and the private sector so vital that their disruption would have a debilitating effect on the nation. It's a very noble definition and quite the recipe for paralysis, because if everything is now critical, arguably, any project manager could tell you this, nothing truly is. So the National Security Memorandum 22, or NSM 22, was meant to modernize how those functions are managed. And in theory, it decentralizes that responsibility, letting federal agencies and private operators tailor protections to their own risk environment, which in practice creates a kind of a policy map full of overlapping boundaries where accountability is very blurry and resources are very much scattered. It's a patchwork of agencies, regulators, and corporate partners, each holding a piece of the responsibility, but no one has the full picture. The current U.S. administration is reviewing those policies, trying to clarify who's responsible for what, but the underlying trend here isn't changing, and that is that we keep expanding the definition of critical without actually strengthening the coordination behind that label. The result is expansion without coherence, protection without prioritization, and a growing sense that this system is just too diffuse to be meaningfully defended. It's the bystander effect. If everyone is responsible, no one really is and no one steps up. So let's shift to like the European model, where they focus on bureaucracy. So it's something of the opposite approach, where the U.S. is now like delegating to states or private enterprises, the European Union codifies. Under the NIS2 directive and the Critical Entities Resilience Directive, yes, the names tell you alone what you're kind of in for, you get a remarkable range of organizations, from cloud providers to wastewater plants, all of these falling under quote-unquote essential or important categories. Each is required to prove compliance with detailed risk management, incident reporting, and supply chain security measures. It's kind of tempting to see that as just bureaucratic overreach, and arguably it is. But it's also effective in its own strange little way. A friend of mine once pointed out that bureaucracy is its own form of resilience because it forces repeatable, auditable behavior even as it slows everything down. Now, under NIS2, an outage may still happen, but the recovery process is at least predictable. You may not like the paperwork, but you'll have the paperwork. And sometimes that's actually half the battle. Still, the EU's approach has its limits. If the US risks diffusion, what the EU is looking at is inertia. And both of those activities are being confused with assurance that things will be available. Expanding the oversight doesn't guarantee protection. It does guarantee documentation. Protection might just kind of be a happy accident. To both those systems, where the diffused responsibility and the codifying of what to do, they kind of face the underlying dilemma of interdependence. Interdependence magnifies both stability and fragility. A local failure can ripple across sectors and turn into a global event, as we have seen. But interdependence also gives us recovery pathways, shared infrastructure that can reroute and restore. When an AWS region fails, another often picks up the load. That redundancy is designed resilience, but it's not limitless, again, as we saw. And the paradox of microservice design is that it creates that local resilience, but a global fragility. The more distributed the system, the harder it is to fully understand its points of failure. And when everything depends on everything else, the concept of critical infrastructure starts to feel a little meaningless. So the real question isn't how to eliminate dependencies, because you can't do that, but to decide which ones we can live with and which ones we can't. That brings us to coordination, or increasingly, the lack of it. A recent report from the Carnegie Endowment put it pretty bluntly that the challenge is no longer whether to protect critical systems, but how to coordinate that protection across borders. The internet made infrastructure transnational. Regulation, however, still stops at the border. And the wider the gap between those two realities, the shakier everything gets. Now, this tension I talked about a little bit in my earlier series, The End of the Global Internet. Fragmentation through data localization mandates, competing standards, and good old-fashioned geopolitical distrust is shrinking the space for cooperation. We're trying to protect a global network at a time when global cooperation is kind of pretty low. During the October AWS outage, the reactions were immediate, fairly revealing. In the UK, politicians revived their debates about tech sovereignty. In Brussels, they focused on limiting reliance on American hyperscalers. And tech journalists sort of across the board summed it up very well, that a global AWS outage exposes very fragile digital foundations, and they're not wrong. But this technical failure becomes just more political ammunition because the question is now shifting from uptime to control. Who controls the tools that we can't seem to function without? Once something is labeled critical, because you can't function without it, every government wants jurisdiction, every region wants its own version. The intent is protection. The result is fragmentation. So the same tension plays out, you know, in global debates around digital public infrastructure, or DPI. DPI emphasizes inclusion, interoperability, and openness. I love those words. Those are great words. Critical information infrastructure, or CII, emphasizes security, restriction, and control. Not my favorite words, but I understand why they are used. Both serve public purposes, right? They just start from very different, we'll call them design instincts. I mean, you can look, for example, to India's Aadhaar identity system. It illustrates this kind of tension very, very well. It began as an open, widely used public platform, a way to extend services. 5 years later, it was reclassified as a protected system under India's critical infrastructure rules. That reclassification was probably necessary. You do not want national identity data floating around unprotected. U.S. But it also raises an awkward question. Should systems managing that level of personal data ever have operated without those protections in the first place? If you move too early, you're going to stifle innovation. But if you move too late, you're going to amplify harm. The challenge is timing and trust. How do we decide when openness must yield to oversight, and how do we preserve public confidence when that shift happens? The concept of critical infrastructure has always been political. Declaring something critical signals seriousness and invites attention, funding, and control. In a digital economy, criticality itself becomes a kind of currency which can attract investment, and it can also attract lobbying and regulatory capture. The analog world already blurred this line a bit between public good and private gain, and the digital world just does it faster and at scale. Ultimately, criticality is becoming an interesting negotiation, and like any negotiation, it depends less on evidence and more on influence. If a nation declares a platform critical, is that for resilience or is it for leverage? Well, honestly, it's probably both. And that's what makes the paradox so persistent. Protection is never actually neutral. It is a political act. If the previous blog post, "The Infrastructure We Forgot We Built," was about recognizing new kinds of critical systems, then this post is a reflection that argues for restraint. Declaring everything critical doesn't make society safer. It makes prioritization impossible. Resilience requires hierarchy, knowing what must endure, what can fail safely, and how recovery can work in between. And that's not a comfortable place to be for policymakers or service providers. Safety, it sounds equitable. Prioritization sounds kind of elitist because you're automatically putting something in there saying you can have support, but you, well, good luck. Resilience basically demands making a choice. It asks us to acknowledge that some dependencies matter more than others, and it challenges us to build systems that can tolerate failure instead of pretending failure won't happen. So the more we classify, the more we appear to protect, and the less we're able to control when it matters most. So maybe the real task ahead isn't about expanding the list of critical infrastructure. It's learning to live with a smaller list, to practice selective resilience rather than universal ambition. Because protection at its core is about trade-offs between autonomy and interdependence, between openness and control, between the systems we want to trust and the ones that we're forced to. Perhaps that's the real paradox, right? The harder we try and protect everything, the more fragile we're going to make the whole. So with that, thanks for listening. We're going to have another post next week on another way to look at critical infrastructure. I hope you join in. I hope you share it with your friends, and I hope you debate about it. If there's stuff that you don't agree with or want me to explore more, I'd love to hear your perspectives. And that's it for this week's episode of the Digital Identity Digest. If it helps make things a little clearer, or at least a little more interesting, share it with a friend or colleague and connect with me on LinkedIn at HL Flanagan. And if you enjoyed the show, do be sure to subscribe and leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find the written full post at sphericalcowconsulting.com. Now stay curious, stay engaged, and let's get these conversations going.